Domestic violence, sadly, is very common. It accounts for between 16 and 25% of all reported crime in the UK. If you consider that most cases of domestic violence remain unreported, the real number's probably much higher. Research shows that domestic abuse mostly affects women. In the UK alone, one in four women will experience some form of domestic violence in their lifetime. Domestic violence also affects children, men, and elderly people alike, and it's extremely important to raise awareness of this issue. We've recorded a series of podcasts examining the realities of domestic abuse, as personal stories often speak louder than statistics. Sarah is a young mother who has suffered domestic abuse. This is her story.
We was together for, I'd say, about a year and 3 months or so, and everything was fine. We was spending a lot of time together. We got on, we was living together. About 6 months after we was together, we decided to try for a baby. My son was born, and then I'd say about 5 months after that, that's when it first all started. Basically, we just had an argument and he just reacted. He just went mad, basically. I didn't expect that from him at all, but I don't know what I said, to be quite honest, that day. But I just remember literally holding the kitchen door shut and after that being beaten up, basically. After it first happened, he was very apologetic and he even started to cry. He helped me to clean up my face. The next day, he took me to hospital to get checked out, and because I needed like some butterfly stitches and where I had a really bad cut. Even in the hospital, he was crying, saying that, oh, look, they can see what I've done to you. I feel so bad and whatever, whatever. But obviously, it was just an act. After that, everything was fine. I decided to take him back and we got on again. It's like back to how it was when we first met. We decided to have another baby. I had my daughter. And then after that, again, I'll probably say about 6 months down the line, about 4 months, unnecessarily, it was something so trivial. My daughter had a cold. I was putting Vicks on her. As a baby gets frustrated, she was hungry in the middle of the night. I was a bit, ooh, what do I do? I'm trying to do everything to clear her nose. It's not working. So I was getting a bit flustered. He suggested a way. I basically just said, oh, why don't you do it? And literally, that was it. Left my daughter on the bed and he just went mad. After that, then obviously I realised that he might not change. We went on holiday a few months later. He saw the bruises all over my ribs and he asked me what happened. I said, well, you did it. He then again got upset, said he was sorry. He didn't realise he's got an anger problem. And that lasted for about a month. Then it was just getting ridiculous. I couldn't really say anything. If I had an opinion, he'd like smack me or something just to say, like, be quiet. Or who do you think you're talking to? If I answered back, so to say, then the same thing would happen. We decided it wasn't working between us. We're different type of people. And to split up and go our separate ways. But then again, he was making it difficult because we were in a three-bedroom house and if I'm moving on my own, obviously I've got to do a thing on my own on one budget. So I'm saying, well, I might need to get a two-bedroom flat and the children share. Oh no, they're used to a house. Or that if you're going to get a flat, they need three bedrooms. Then I'll look for a three-bedroom flat. I know they need a garden. They're used to a garden. So you're trying to make it very difficult. So I just decided to get on with my life, continue working. I started having more of a social life, meeting up with friends. If I asked him to look after the children, he would always tell me, I can't babysit, I've got things to do. I'd ask my mum or family to help. Sometimes I'd stay at my mum's house. He didn't like the fact that I was getting more independent and kind of, I was opening up more. Like, he could see I was more happy. So basically, one night he totally violated me. From then, I was like, I need to get out. That was just, like, for me, a big eye-opener. Again, after that, he was still abusive. So I asked a friend, or I confided in a friend, and that friend had actually another friend that had gone through an abusive relationship. So I started speaking to her. She started helping me, finding where there's Women's Aid, and she was telling me where I can go to get help. And then I found out about where to go with Women's Aid in my area, because each individual borough, you just call your local council and they can tell you, and what days and times and so forth. So I confided in my cousin, and she said she'd come with me. To be quite honest, for me, it was very nerve-wracking when you're trying to leave. So what I did was I just continued my normal life. So I knew I was going, but I didn't want it to seem obvious. So I kind of like was doing a clear out, go through my wardrobe, tidying up and stuff, made sure that I had my passport. I wanted the children's, but they were in his drawer, so I didn't want it to be obvious that I've taken them. So I just took their birth certificates, medical documents and so forth, any documents that I needed, bills and stuff, so I could change them, put them in a little envelope in my bag. And then I still went shopping. I bought food to cook. I was actually going to cook the night before. And that day, he just thought I was going to work as normal. Luckily for me, what I normally did is I did washing, and then in the morning I'd take it to the laundrette to be tumble dried and folded. So I kind of just did a few loads, put it in a big bag and took that with me. So it was just seemed like I was just doing my normal daily routine. I would say don't try and do anything at the norm, because that's when they might seem suspicious. So I dropped the kids to nursery and then called my cousin, met up with her. I went to Women's Aid, and basically you go there, they make you feel at ease. You just got to explain your story. You don't have to go with someone, you can go by yourself if you find it easier. And to be quite honest, once I got it all off my chest there and then, I did feel a bit better. It was easier to kind of speak about it after I've said it all, because I hadn't actually told anyone the fullness of it. But then they put you in a risk. They do a risk assessment on you, and they classified me as high risk. So, but they said to me I could go to a refuge, but not today because of the time, because refuges, I don't know why, but they have certain times, obviously, because staff only work certain hours. So I was like, oh, I can't go back. I've gone now. What am I going to do? Luckily for me, I had somewhere I could stay that he didn't know where they lived, one of my mum's friends. So I stayed there the next morning. I went straight to the refuge.
How scared were you in the actual leaving?
And that night, to be quite honest, when he came in, I was a bit on edge. I didn't want to seem like I was doing anything out of the norm. So I still kind of had a conversation as I would. I did go to bed early because I felt really nervous. Like, I felt like, I don't know, my hand shaking, or did my eyes look dodgy, or can you tell I'm lying about something? So I was very scared, to be quite honest. But even the day I left and I went to the Women's Aid, after I went to Women's Aid, I directly went to my stepmum, because I was meant to be going to see my sister. She just got out of hospital. And he called me while I was there because he knew I was going there because I had the day off work. And when he called me, he was just simply saying, oh, what are you doing for dinner? Are you cooking? Is it going to be normal time, or should I get something to eat because I'm out? So I was just like, oh, yeah, remember, I've got the fish in the fridge. I'll cook it when I come home. And it was weird because even my stepmum said, I quickly switched from pacing up and down the house, being nervous, being like, Mum, hurry up and get here. I want to get out. To when I spoke on the phone to him, I kind of just switched back and was like, oh, yeah, no, I'm cooking. I'll be in normal time. Dinner will be ready for 6. And that was the conversation. That was the last conversation I had with him.
Tell us why you didn't leave earlier with those very extreme incidents. Why did you not go before?
To be quite honest, the first time it happened, I wanted to leave. But then when he started apologising and crying, and because of the type of man he was, I didn't expect him to react like that. I actually thought he was genuinely sorry, or he came across that like he was. And then the second time it happened, again, because it didn't happen for so long in between, I had my daughter, and she was a few months after, so we had another year and a bit together, and it was fine. So I thought maybe it was just how I reacted. I just kept on thinking, was it me? Like, did I suddenly say something that was really rude, or did I try and size him up like I was a man as well? So, but then after that, once I realised, to be quite honest, not that it was too late, but it was harder to leave because I was scared of leaving. To be quite honest, leaving, it's the fear that gets you more than actually doing it. Once you're doing it or you're halfway there, you think I might as well just do it, and you've done it and you feel relieved. But it's the whole leading up to it that gets you really nervous, and you think, oh my gosh, what happens if I get caught? What is he going to do to me? That's why I say to everyone, just try and keep normal, stick to your normal routine, don't do anything out of the norm. So you don't, even if it's a matter of going with nothing. I literally, when I left, I didn't even look at the washing I'd done. Most of the washing I had in the bag was his washing and the kids. I had nothing. I had about two tops. I had to go and buy a whole new wardrobe. But again, it's just material stuff. I left everything behind, my whole house, all my goods, TV, sofas, everything. Because at the end of the day, it's material stuff. It can be replaced. I wouldn't say try and take anything, just worry about yourself, your safety and your children if you do have.
Was there a danger, do you think, that if it had have gone on, you'd have accepted this as normal, this is your life? Can you see why women get locked in that sort of situation?
Yeah, because they get scared and they think that if they get caught, then it's going to be worse or they could end up dead. Because then, for instance, when I looked on Women's Aid on the internet, the first thing that I read was that 1 in 4 women die from domestic violence. And you can either look at it and think, oh my gosh, I need to get out, or you can look at it and think, oh my gosh, that could be me. So I can understand why they stay, but I just think the longer you stay, the harder it is.
Did you blame yourself for his behaviour?
At first, I did used to think, was it how I reacted, or was I saying the wrong things, or as a woman, was I not meant to answer back to a man? I used to think, oh, like, if I said something and he just gave me one slap, that, okay, one slap I could probably accept. But when you do the extreme, when you've got bruised ribs or black eye or split face, or then that's completely taking it to the extreme. But then now that I'm out, I see it as, no, I didn't do anything wrong, because I'm an adult, I've got opinions, everyone's allowed their own opinion, and no one should control you, to be quite honest.
You've mentioned Women's Aid and going into a refuge. How did it feel to, with two small children as well, to uproot yourself, your children, having to sort of, you know, sever the links that you've had in the past? Tell us a little bit about when you first made that decision and what happened when you went into a refuge.
Okay, going into a refuge can be very hard, because obviously you've picked yourself up, you've left everything, your friends, your family. Some refuges, you are allowed visitors as long as they do checks on them. But where I was, which I didn't realise till I got there, because you get to choose which refuge, they tell you the areas were available and then you can go to that area. So I could have gone to, for instance, Sheffield or Manchester. But the refuge that I was in, I didn't realise you're not allowed any visitors. They're not even allowed to come to the road. You can tell them the area and they could pick, you meet them at the top of the road. You can't even order something simple as a takeaway. You fancy Chinese, you can't order it. You go to Tesco's, you can't get a cab back home. You got to get the cab to the top of the road and then walk down with the shopping. It was just like, even that I drove, for instance, I didn't bring my car because I didn't want to get followed or be seen. But at the same time, when I did get a new car, I couldn't park it near the refuge because in case anyone did see me in that new car, then they could tell. So it was a big adjustment because obviously just simple things that you do. For instance, oh, you're at home after school and you want a takeaway. So it's hard, but I was lucky enough that I had support and I made friends there, because you can either be in a shared house, which I was, or some of them you have self-contained apartments, kind of like a one-bedroom ensuite. But then because I was in a shared house and it was only myself and another girl and she had 4 children, we really got on and tried to help each other out and do things together. We supported each other. But then again, if you're in, you could be in a house and, oh, like when I was there, after about 3 months, you get girls come in and I don't know, they're coming off heroin. So then the whole dynamics of the house change. Or you get people and they're very dirty, they leave cups and plates and leave it on the side and don't wash up. And then obviously you've got children, there's health and safety risk, the whole house gets in trouble for it, not just that one person. So it can be quite hard, but you've got to be positive about it and just think, look, I'm safer and I'm better than where I was. I'm not going to be here forever. I'm going to be housed, whether it's private or council or whatever you're going to do. You're going to move on, you're going to get your own place and you will settle. But for me, the harder part was leaving the refuge and starting a new life in a new area on my own. Because in the refuge, you've got support. When you leave, you haven't got support. You're doing it on your own.
Tell us a little bit about that support. What was it like when you first shared your story, the pain of the story, with somebody else, with, you know, now in a completely different environment with your children and everything?
Well, you don't do anything in front of the children. They've got a child support worker that works there and they have like play sessions. I mean, it's a lot of form filling when you get there. Literally, you have to fill out loads of forms. You've got a key worker and they go through everything, literally, like even your bills, getting your names changed. Because obviously, what happened with me was, even though I stopped my bills, somehow I ended up getting like this mad £350 gas bill for 1 month. And then obviously if you're not working, which you can't work because you're in the refuge, they help you if you're not sure what to do. So they've got support there. They don't talk in front of the children. They'll always have someone to occupy them and do something with them. But then obviously once things start coming up, there's certain things that you've got to remember in a refuge. If you tell them, then they have to follow the law, whether it's social services, police. So then it's kind of, you're going through it all again, you have to keep on repeating yourself. So it can get quite annoying in a sense, but it's there to help you.
You mentioned a bit about life in the refuge, particularly with regard to the children. Mm-hmm. Was it a harder decision to make to go into a refuge knowing you had young children?
For me, yeah. Because I did used to think, oh my gosh, what am I doing here? Why am I here? You can go in a refuge from any walk of life. Don't ask you questions about your family, your upbringing, and they'll think, oh, how did you get there? It's like, well, it's nothing to do with where you've been brought up. It's who you meet and who you fall in love with. And I probably not would have looked down on people, but would have looked like, I wouldn't have thought your normal everyday person necessarily is going to be in a refuge, which now I know you do. It's hard, but it gets easier.
Let's talk a little bit about your personal faith and whether mm-hmm. that's something that you found encouraging. I know when we talked before, you mentioned that your partner was, in a sense, trying to control your beliefs as well.
Yeah.
So talk to us a bit about your faith and how that helps.
Okay, well, it was all weird. I was brought up as a Catholic. I went to church, not every Sunday, but every Christmas, Easter. We always do that as a family. Go to church and then have a celebration after or something. My partner, he allowed me to have my children christened as Catholics. He was like, all right, I'll do that because you're family and I know how much they're into religion and stuff. But then after the christening, it was like, what are you going to church for? If I had anything to say, it would be like, but hold on, how much do you know about this? I've read the whole Bible, I've read the whole Quran. How much of the Bible have you read? What, because you went to a Catholic school, you think you know everything? And then I kind of got thinking, well, hold on. If there is a God, why is this happening to me? Why am I going through this? It just gets ridiculous because your mind's just going constantly questioning everything. So I kind of stopped believing in a sense. And I was like, well, I don't know what to believe in. I don't believe in anything now because this is happening to me. Then after we broke up, I said, you know what? I'm actually going to go back to church. Because I met someone and she used to encourage me and say things that actually made sense to me. And he was like, no, you don't need to go to church. I don't want my children to go to church. What are you going to church for? I'd rather you go to Nation of Islam. I'm not Muslim. Yeah, but they talk more sense. It's more real than the church and this and that. And so I used to be like, okay, do you know what? I'm not going to nothing then because I'm not going to change and suddenly start following Islamic rules. And I'm not being brought up like that. It can make you think, but then on the flip side, you've got like for me, I see it as I'm lucky. I got out when I did. I'm not there 20, 30 years later putting up with it. I'm not dead. I'm alive still. I'm still able to get on with my life. Okay, fair enough. I've had a drastic change and it's harder and I've got to start a new life, but I'm still able and I've had the chance to do that.
Did you ever feel, I mean, I know you said that you're probably pretty disillusioned with religion full stop at that point, but did you feel you could pray when it got desperate? Was there any of that, or was it just not on the agenda?
I did. I would sometimes pray with a girl at work and even at home, or something silly, like I'd be dropping my son to nursery and I'd suddenly think, oh, please, God, just answer this one prayer.
You came into contact with people that were praying for you and just getting that sort of Christian support. Did you find that helpful?
Yeah, I did. Because even though I wasn't going to church and I wasn't necessarily sure if I was believing, but then I had a good friend and she always was like, I'm praying for you every night, don't worry. And she would pray with me. And even though I was still a bit not sure, but like she said, she always says to me, look, your prayers have been answered because you're out. And it didn't take that long. Once I made a decision that I was going, within a month and a half, I was gone.
Let's look a little bit to the future now. That's what it's all about at the minute.
Yep.
So you made the big decision, the difficult mm-hmm. decision. You lived yourself and with your children in a very difficult environment for a good while. And you were just saying actually how hard it is to move from the refuge to another place.
Yeah.
How's that going at the minute?
To be quite honest, I've moved into my own place. In the beginning, I started doing it up and making it feel comfortable for myself, the children, make sure their room was how they wanted it. My son wanted bed 10 and my daughter with a pink room. So I kind of done that for them. But then once it all slows down a bit, you do sit down and you start to wonder and think, and you think, do you know what? You're still going to be able to live a normal life. I've got to change my life. It's not fair, but I'm the type of person, I just think it's happened and I need to move on from it and get on with it as much as I can. And I mean, I'm trying to look for work and get on with my life, but it can be hard and it is easy to fall into a trap and sit down and start thinking and wondering and getting depressed. But I would just say, try not to, be positive and just think, well, look, I'm lucky I got out and I've still got a life. I mean, I've got much of a life ahead of me.
Might be a difficult question, but mm-hmm. were there times when you thought, am I a good mother? Did you question how your own parenting and stuff when he was, you know, did you feel you should have left much earlier for the children?
Yeah, because he was quite hard on my son. But then at the same time, I was scared of how he was going to react to me as well. So I didn't necessarily react how I should have, because as a mother, you're meant to protect your children. And I felt that I could have protected him more. But then I also felt that if I did, it's better that he's got a mum than to not have a mum at all. So, I mean, for me, I've taken him out of the situation and they're still young. And like, children are just very easy. It is hard. They will ask questions. They might say things, but you just got to explain to them or try and, I don't know, just make their mind at ease. Say, even if it's, they'll ask a question about their dad or where is dad? And I just say, oh, he's not here anymore.
What would you say to someone if you almost looked at yourself, first time it had happened, you know, first time you've been abused by someone you trusted and loved, what would you say to that person? Would you say get out immediately? What advice would you give them?
It's hard because there is people out there who may do something out of the norm and not do it again and be genuinely sorry. But for me personally, I would say while you've got the strength and the courage, try and leave the first time. And once you do go as well, try not to go back, because it is hard. And many women do go back and think that the man's changed and then they go back into refuge. I mean, I've met women that have been in refuge 3 or 4 times and they're still considering going back.
And as far as you're concerned, what is out there? I mean, you've mentioned the route you went down, but what is out there for women that are facing domestic abuse?
There is centres, or like, for instance, where Women's Aid are, you could just generally go and have a chat with them. You don't have to go to refuge. They don't have to help you. But it's just to get everything off your chest. It might make it easier for you to deal with it. And then they just can give you advice, tell you where you can get help, what kind of help and support. But then, like I said, they do a risk assessment. So if you are medium to high risk, just when you go there, to me, I just say be open, tell them everything, because they're not going to look at you different. It's a job for them. They've trained to do this. And if you are medium to high risk, even if you're low risk and you can get out, it's easier to get out while you are low risk because you don't want to be high risk.
If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this podcast, please visit our website, www.cedar.uk.net, for further information and resources. If you need help now, please call the National Domestic Violence Helpline on 0808 2000 247. That's 0808 2000 247 for confidential and professional support.